I'm Eric Colts, and welcome back to 90 Feet Away. As you know, on our show, we're talking about different people's journeys through this game, not just playing the game, helping other people through the game, their day-to-day, coaching, mental health, overcoming adversity. And today, I am joined by one of my favorite human beings, Coach Matt Perper. Matt Perper and I have known each other for a very long time. In doing some recon on Matt, I actually found out yesterday that I coached against him, not as a coach. I coached against him when I coached in Manhattanville College, and he was still a collegiate baseball player at Western Connecticut University. And I think I met Coach Perper probably almost 20 years ago at this point. Yeah, it's about 18 years ago. And Matt Perper joins us today and is going to share some of his journey through baseball. Matt, welcome, and thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me, man. I'm really excited.
Good. I wanted to start out with your journey. You're born and raised in Rockland County, played a lot of baseball growing up, and Clarkstown kid. What was your journey like in high school? What was your recruiting process like for yourself?
Yeah, it was totally different than it is today. Definitely. I was probably recruited more towards my senior year. I had about, I would say, 3 to 5 schools, mostly Division II, Division III. And then I got the opportunity to play Western Connecticut. That was probably my best opportunity to play right away. And I was fortunate enough to be able to do both pitch and hit, which some schools obviously weren't going to allow me to do. And then basically just took it from there. Played 5 years at Western Connecticut State, redshirted a year. And I had a good college career. Definitely some things I would like to have back as usual, but we all do, of course. But at the same time, I'm grateful for that opportunity because it got me to love baseball more than I did in high school and then kind of take me to that next level.
Was it the opportunity to be able to be a two-way that attracted you to Western Connecticut? Most kids are not Shohei Ohtani, right? They don't have an opportunity to be two ways. Was that a big, crucial decision-making point in your journey?
I think it was part of it because for me, I wanted to at least have the opportunity to do both. And then if it took me one way or the other, which eventually it took me more on the hitting side, that gave me that opportunity. The other schools were kind of just wanted me to stay on the mound. And I loved pitching. I just don't know if I loved it as much as being on the field every day and getting an opportunity to hit.
So. Interesting. You know, just as a sidebar, this is such an important point for kids. Every kid wants to play Division I, right? Every kid that you ever met wants to be a Division I baseball player. Kids don't understand that less than 2% of every baseball player ever becomes a Division I athlete. Maybe 1% finishes the 4 years. I've told kids for years, go somewhere you're going to have an opportunity to compete once you walk through the door, and you know, maybe it's not as sexy, right? It's not as sexy to be a Division II, Division III baseball player, but there are certain tremendous baseball players at the Division II and Division III levels.
Probably some of the better guys I ever coached were at the Division II and the Division III levels.
Okay.
For sure.
Awesome. So you have your 5 years at Western. It's a pretty good experience for you. How did you start your journey in coaching, and how did that go? You know, was it as a grad assistant? Talk about that.
Yeah, so I started coaching at my alma mater at Western Connecticut State. Coach Susie gave me the opportunity to do that. I actually got a job out of school working for an energy company, and it wasn't for me. Probably 6-8 months in, I just, you know, didn't think that that was kind of where my journey should continue. And I got the opportunity to coach at Western for, you know, making pennies on the dollar, but just the opportunity to help guys. I think for me, when I played, there were certain things that I felt like I could have handled differently. So as a coach, I wanted to always be the guy that I needed, right? That somebody else can have for themselves. So for me, that was the biggest reason why I went into coaching. Coach Soucy gave me the opportunity there and kind of hit the ground running. You know, it's a little difficult coaching kids that you played with.
I was just going to say, yeah. Like I've been around the game a little bit too. Yep. Yep. And literally you're going from a fifth year senior where you're going out with these guys, you're having a couple beers with these guys, to now they're looking at you as coach. Yep. That's a really young age to have made that decision that you wanted to help the younger guys. That's a pretty mature decision at that age. I haven't heard many people at that age really understanding or being that understanding. How'd that go?
Yeah, I think it was difficult early on. I think there were certain guys that kind of wanted to see me in action a little bit more before they started to buy in. I was really big on being prepared because I knew that if I wasn't prepared, these guys would see it immediately. So I was very big on practice plans, very big on things like that, so that these guys knew that I was invested. Most of the guys I've ever coached, they want to know that you're invested and they'll be invested. So, for me, that was a big part of it, is kind of letting them see that I'm super involved. And then it kind of got better as the years went by. As I got a little bit older, I knew how to handle certain situations. But at the beginning, it was certainly rocky.
How long did you stay at Western?
I stayed there for 3 years.
So, as you got more experience and older, and then the guys you hung out with started to cycle out and graduate, did it become easier for you, for the younger guys, to buy into who Coach Perper was?
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
That's a huge step. That was a huge step for me.
So after 3 years, you know, Coach Soucy gives you this opportunity to start your journey. You make a decision. You want to pursue coaching in college.
Yep.
After 3 years, an opportunity comes up, and you go to?
Iona College.
Iona College is not exactly the hotbed of Division I baseball. Not the easiest place to recruit guys to. Not great facilities. They didn't even have their own field at that point, correct? You were renting City Park in New Rochelle. Yep. But you went from a Division III coach to a Division I coach. Obviously, you were pretty excited about that. How did that journey go for you?
It was interesting, to say the least. When I got there, it was just different. You know, between a 56-game season, between Division I allowing more things to happen, more practice time, more, you know, for Division III, it's a 40-game season. You don't get a big fall. When I was there, it was 16 dates, so we practiced 4 days a week for a month, and we were done.
And for people to understand, that's dates. That's not games.
Correct.
That is dates. That is practice and or games. And at the time, I believe Division III was allowed 1 day of competition.
That's correct.
You could play 17 games in 1 day, but it had to be over in 1 day. Okay.
Had to be over in 1 day.
Go on.
So we had more practice time at Iona. We had the ability to have individuals working one-on-one with guys, which was huge for me because as the more I coach, the relationships are the most important thing, as you know. If I can get on the same level, the same as my players, I feel like we can relate better. And that goes for everything I've ever done. You want to try to be involved in not just their baseball, but their daily life, you know, how's things going at home, things like that. So I had more of an opportunity to be kind of engaged with the guys.
You had a tremendous connection. I remember watching the kids with you. It was natural, right? Yeah. There was nothing for us. You were younger. You were the youngest assistant coach. One of my things about you is I think you've always been very relatable, and it was easy for the kids. What was different, other than the schedule, practices, games? What was different from a Western at D3 to an Iona at D1?
Yeah, I mean, the competition for sure. You know, we would always open up with some pretty tough competition, and that's where I got my feet wet. You know, I was used to, you know, coaching Division III, playing Division III, and then we open up with, I believe, William and Mary was my first taste. They scored 23 runs on us on a Friday night.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just different. The atmosphere was different. But for me, I really got the opportunity to see what it was like, know that this was what I wanted to do, and then just kind of run with it.
So at this point, right, you're still, how old are you at Iona?
Yeah, so I was 25, I believe.
25 years old, and you're making great money at this point, right?
$6,000.
So $6,000. So we go from a Division III coach making probably somewhere in the area of $2,500, if I'm correct.
That's correct.
And as a second assistant, a third coach at Iona College, people think that, it's just the most incredible thing to be involved with a Division I program. Your salary for the year was $6,000.
$6,000.
How'd you survive?
Yeah, it's a good question. Hustling, being able to, when there wasn't practice time or office time, to get into places like this that allowed me the opportunity to do lessons, even if it was 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night, I had to be able to make that secondary income so that I can, live.
Okay.
But yeah, a lot of lessons, a lot of side gigs, a lot of camps, a lot of things like that to just kind of keep me afloat.
And mental and emotional and some financial support from your parents as well, right?
Yeah,
you definitely needed help.
Definitely, there's no doubt they've always been there for me, and that's obviously a humongous part of this whole process. It's hard to do alone.
So you're at Iona for how long?
3 years.
3 years at Iona, for several reasons. It just wasn't the right situation for you. As I mentioned, hard to recruit guys there, not a fully funded program. So hard to spread money around to really, decent prospects. You get an opportunity. So you end up at Southern New Hampshire University, which is a phenomenal Division II program. You go from living in Connecticut and commuting to New York. You're now living in
Manchester, New Hampshire.
Manchester, New Hampshire. So you go from a Division III at Western Connecticut to Iona Division I, and you take a step back to Division II. Was it a step back?
To be honest, no.
Right. It turned out to be like one of the best coaching experiences that you've had. Go on.
Yeah, I was only there for a year. It's actually funny. I was talking to Corey Mascara at the time. Corey was the St. John's pitching coach at the time. He's now the Wake Forest pitching coach. And Corey said to me, I got a buddy, Scott Loazzo. He may need an assistant up at SNU. Really good program. Obviously, you're going to have to relocate. It's something to think about. So obviously, the gears start turning in my head, and I said, you know what, maybe this is the opportunity that I need to be. Just go out, kind of go to a different area of the country, and kind of feel things out. By far my best coaching experience in college. Scott, as I said, was just awesome. He allowed his assistants to kind of be part of the process. That was a little bit less for me at my other stops. But it allowed me to kind of understand the game from like a different perspective, knowing writing practice plans with the whole coaching staff there, making decisions with the whole coaching staff there. I think that was important for me to kind of see,
Do you think that's one of the reasons that they are historically successful?
No doubt about it.
So, as a coach, I have never been an ego guy. I think that my job is to understand what my weaknesses are and then surround myself with guys that can pick those weaknesses up. And then together we become incredibly strong. I don't understand why more guys don't think that way. Maybe they're scared for their job. Maybe they're insecure. But Coach Loazzo, I've only met him a couple of times. Obviously, successful, confident in who he is, and the team does incredibly well every year.
Incredibly well.
Why was that only a year, Matt?
Because I got the opportunity to go back to Division I, and I met the head coach at UMass Lowell, Ken Herring, and he knew that I was a big recruiter. One of the things that I learned early on coaching, kind of after WestCon, was you're only as good as the players you recruit. And that for me was like a huge part of how I coached, because as much as we love to be on the field and working with guys, there's a part that we need to go find players and attract them to the school that you're at, whether it's at Iona, whether it's at Southern New Hampshire. And the ability to find players and then start to kind of relate and things like that was a very big part for me.
So I happen to know, but
yeah,
tell the audience, your favorite thing to do is teach hitting.
Love it.
Right. But they didn't have a hitting position open at UMass Lowell.
Correct.
So what happened?
So Ken asked me, because of my recruiting and a little bit of pitching along the way, he asked me to be their pitching coach. And I was super, super kind of taken back. I didn't know what to think. And then I just said, you know what? This is part of it. This is part of this journey. And I honestly loved every second of it. I missed coaching hitting for that year, but at the same time, I really enjoyed it, because it just gave me a different perspective. Calling pitches, seeing what hitters do. Now you're calling certain parts of the game based on what you're watching as a hitter, knowing what hitters look for and things like that. So that was like super, super cool.
Were you nervous at first? My thing about this is, right, coaching at any kind of decent level is the imposter syndrome.
Sure.
Right?
Yep.
These kids are Division I pitchers.
Yep.
You really hadn't worked on the craft of coaching pitching as much as you had hitting.
Yep.
But yet you walk in as a Division I pitching coach.
Yep.
Nervous a little bit at first?
Yeah, definitely. That's why, as I talked about being prepared before, I had many of phone calls that summer with a lot of people that I see as really good pitching people. A lot of guys in the college game, some guys in the pro game, just asking them kind of what to do, like how to, because I know pitching, but at the same time, I want to be caught up. As we know with baseball, everything is, if you're behind a year or two, you're behind big time. So I got the opportunity to call a ton of people that I knew just through coaching and things like that, and sat down with them and discussed things. And that made me a little bit more prepared, but nothing can make you prepared for a Friday night in Nashville against Vanderbilt calling pitches. So,
That was a
little bit of a rude awakening for me. But at the same time, I mean, what an experience to be able to, you know, be in a situation like that and have the opportunity to do that. But yeah, at first it was definitely a little bit challenging, but
I imagine it was like crazy intimidating, yes. You know, so you're at UMass for also one year.
Yep.
And another opportunity comes your way.
Yeah, so right after UMass, I got a call from a buddy of mine, John Grasse. He was the pitching coach at Brown at the time. And he said, hey, we have an opening on our staff, really want you. And took me a little while. Obviously, I had to talk over some things with my family. And I said, you know what, we'll start moving our way back down the East Coast. And made a home in Providence for a year and really enjoyed it, because, as you know, with the Ivy, it's just a different ballgame.
The Ivy League is totally different, but, you know, within a very short time, relatively, you know, you start out as a grad assistant at Western, and within 3 years, you're a Division I coach, and you take this job at SNU to Lowell, and now you're in the Ivy League. And there's a lot of great about the Ivy League. There's some not so great about the Ivy League. Obviously, in recruiting, you know, there is no athletic money. There is no academic money. The entire Ivy League is based on what they call need-based money. So it's not so easy to, you know, recruit studs. Some of the regulations are similar to Division III. You're limited as far as practices in the fall and how much you can compete in the fall. But you enjoyed that year.
I loved it. I was able to connect with the hitting coach at the time was a guy named Mike McCormick, who really taught me a lot of things in terms of kind of, again, the restricted practice time. So being able to use your time efficiently, because you weren't able to get all that time as we were at some other schools. And Mike's now become a great friend. He's now the hitting coordinator for the San Francisco Giants. we talked the other night for an hour and a half about hitting. Those are the type of relationships that to me are everything. I mean, that's why I'm so glad I did what I did, because although I'm not coaching anymore, I'm able to use those guys as references, as resources. And Mike's a great guy. So John was the pitching coach at the time, got me in and kind of helped him. And the good part about that spot for me was that I was able to help on both sides. So I helped Mike with hitting, but at the same time, if John needed something on the pitching side, I was a year away from coaching pitchers. I had the ability to just kind of, you know, be like a Swiss Army knife and whatever they needed. And it was a cool experience. You know?
So that was a lot of fun for me, right?
Yeah.
That was a lot of fun for me. For people that don't know, my son played at Columbia, and it was his sophomore year, I believe, that you were Brown. And you can't tell because Matt Perper is sitting down right now, but he's probably 6'3", 6'4", and 235, and built like a brick whatever house. And you know, the entire Columbia baseball team was calling him out at first base, if you remember.
I do.
Because you just looked so jacked coaching first base. I remember having some fun during the game, literally during the game, texting you.
You were sitting down the first baseline, right?
I was up in the parking lot on the first baseline, and I was texting you in game, and for me that was a lot of fun anyway. So you spend a year at Brown. I know the kids loved you. I met a bunch of people at the Columbia game. They just thought the world of you. But again, you have a decision to make now, and now this is, I don't know, your eighth, ninth, 10th year coaching. You're still not making money. You're still not able to support yourself, but I believe this is also the time you met the future Mrs. Perper.
Was.
So I now have to start thinking about my future and what I'm going to do to support a family and not necessarily give up baseball, but I can't work for $6,000 or $7,000 or $8,000 a year. I'm now going to have bills to pay.
Yes. The most I ever made coaching in a 12-year career was $20,000 for a year. So definitely challenging. I met my wife at my year at Lowell. And then what was great about that was she's from Providence, so she was able to kind of show me around Providence when I got the job at Brown. I decided that was right around the pandemic, and things were kind of slowing down. And I just said to myself, it's probably better that kind of go in a different direction. And I really have a passion for teaching guys and being in the cage.
So here we go with that. So after a pretty decent career coaching, I mean, you put in a lot of time, all you've known is coaching college ball since you had played college ball.
Yep.
And now you really have to stop and take a look. But the guy who was a two-way player, who had been a hitting coach and a pitching coach, you decide to go out on your own and open up a company, MP Baseball. And talk to me about what got that going and how that started.
Yeah, so at the time when the pandemic started happening, I was very intrigued by getting certifications, understanding certain things with either hitting or just the body in general. And I spoke to a buddy of mine who was coaching, and he was right about to get a job at the Orioles, and he said, there's a really good certification. It talks about the body and hitting and things like that. And I started to kind of get more information from him and said, you know what, I think I want to kind of go down this avenue, kind of teach the body more than kind of just an approach or things like that, although I wanted to stick with that. So I kind of started thinking about doing my own thing, especially with the pandemic. It was very hard with college baseball. Brown didn't have a season at the time. So everything was kind of starting to get a little bit more kind of, I wanted to have a feel for what I wanted to do. And coaching, although I missed it, still do. I thought this was kind of the avenue I wanted to go in. So I started to get certifications, driveline certification, on-base use certification, and I started to kind of dive deeper into the swing itself. And I just fell in love with it. I fell in love with kind of finding what is missing with guys when they come into me and giving them an opportunity to find that. It kind of got me going again. And
so there's a couple of things that are really, really interesting to me about what you do.
Yeah.
You work with 10, 11-year-old kids.
Yep.
You work with college players.
Yep.
You work with first-round draft picks. You work with college All-Americans. One of the things that you touched on at the beginning of the show was being organized, being prepared. What's something that you do to prepare for a session if you're working with one of your 11 or 12 year old players, and how's that different if you're working with a college player or a pro?
Yeah, definitely. I think the most important thing we have to realize is everyone's gonna come in with different talent levels. What I always expect out of the guys I work with, 10, 11, 20, 25, 26, is that they come with the ability to want to get better, listen, and give me the opportunity to let them do something and then kind of give me a dialogue. So there is no, I just teach and talk for 60 minutes. I think it's more about the opportunity for them to tell me how they're feeling. Even as an 11-year-old, I don't know what he's feeling. So I may be telling him what he's doing wrong or what he can do better, and he may not be feeling any of that. He might be feeling only his upper body when we're talking about his feet or his hips. So it varies depending. An 11-year-old, I won't look at as much video because we're just trying to kind of find where they fit, where they can swing from, things like that. Whereas my older guys, I'll always kind of look at video from the session before, see what they're doing well, see what they're not doing well, so that we can attack that early in the session, and then we can kind of just roll through it.
I love the way you use video. So I was a learning disabled kid, so I might not be able to read something and understand it or be told something and understand it. There are plenty of times I'll ask a kid to do something, he doesn't feel what I'm saying, so I need to show him. I think video for you and the way you use video is incredibly helpful to be able to go back to those things to get these kids to where you want them to be. How helpful is it for you?
Yeah, so I think you're referring to the video playback that I have that I set up for my guys, and it's really important once they take a swing to take a look. Now, not for everybody. There are certain guys that are a little, you know, too much up here that we want to just get them the swing. But for the most part, a lot of my guys like to see what they're doing because they'll tell themselves, all right, I got to stay in my hip a little bit better right now. They'll make it, they'll take a swing, they'll take a look and go, I didn't stay as much as I wanted to. So a lot of it is just them getting feedback without us even discussing anything. It's a lot more just me throwing or me feeding the machine, them taking a look and understanding. But really the dialogue that we have is based on if they see something, we'll be able to talk about it, whereas other things.
But not only talk about it, right? Yeah. The way you've got this set up is you can work on something with them and then they can also take that video home. You can forward that video to them. So it's not like, okay, I'm working with Johnny for an hour and by the time he gets home, he's gonna forget everything we talked about. He can take that home and then study that throughout the week. So when he comes back, he's good to go.
Yeah, that's such a huge part because there's only an hour we get a week. So the other 267 hours of the week, what are you doing? What are you hitting off the tee? I love guys that send me video. I love guys that they hit on their own in the days that we're not hitting. They'll send me video because we can make up a lot of ground in those 6 days before I see them again, and they're able to kind of make that adjustment on their own. So yeah, I mean, taking that home and letting them kind of feel their way a little bit when I'm not there, fail a little bit, which is always a good thing, so that they understand that they can, you know, that they can, you know, make adjustments.
Oh boy, did you hit on a tough subject for me. In 2024, parents don't want their kids to fail. They want their kids to get participation trophies for showing up, You know, they went 0 for 4 with 4 punch outs, and it's the umpire's fault, the coach's fault, it's everybody's fault. You have to fail.
Must.
You must fail to be able to understand what it takes to succeed, period, the end. In 2024, we don't allow the kids to fail anymore. So many reasons I could get involved and talk about, but for me, we're so worried about our children feeling good about themselves. And we want to be friends. We want to be friends with our 9-year-old children. I happen to have 3 wonderful children, sure, incredibly successful and great human beings. But as a kid, they failed and I let them. Yep. And then I'd shove a foot up there as needed. Yep. And as adults, they are my friends. Yep. But as children, they needed parents, not friends. And I let them fail, and I wanted them to fail, and I wanted them to do poorly on a test. And they didn't have to be in every AP, because every kid's not gonna be a heart surgeon or a brain surgeon. We need all types. And whether it's in here or outside on a field, they have to fail to learn what they did wrong and be able to overcome that. Which leads me into my next thing with you. You're a baseball coach. Yes, you're a hitting coach. Absolutely. I think one of the best hitting coaches that I've seen. And this has been an incredible journey, and you keep getting better at what you do. But you're not just a coach. You're a therapist. In some cases, you're a big brother.
Yep.
You're a safe place for these kids to have someone when they feel like they're on an island and they're all alone. And I'm not just talking about 11-year-olds. I'm talking about your high-level D1. I'm talking about your pro guys that when they just need someone to talk to, you're the guy. How much of what you do, I know how big it is in what I do.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
I'm half baseball coach and I'm half therapist. Therapist for the kids, therapist for the parents. How big a part of it is for you?
It's, to be honest, it's probably the biggest part for me, especially as the guys get older. This game is incredibly hard. I know it because I wasn't the greatest player. This game is extremely hard, and if you let it beat you up, it will beat you to the ground. And the more I do this, the more I realize that sometimes they just need somebody to talk to. Literally, that's it. It might not be about baseball. It might just be, I got to get this off my chest. And, you know, for me, especially the older guys get, they start to realize that, like, it's a lot less about taking 400 swings in the cage. It's about getting your mind right. And as you start to see the progression of certain guys, it's like in high school, they just want to be in the cage all day, which is great. It's awesome.
Till their hands are bleeding,
right. And then you'll see pro guys, it's like they'll take 30 swings in a session and they feel good because they understand that obviously getting feels and doing everything mechanically is great, but also understanding that if my mind's right, if I feel like I'm in a good place, everything else will take care of itself. And you watch guys that struggle with it. Yesterday, I had a session with a guy, 40 minutes. We just talked about a different mindset when we get up to the plate. 40 minutes of an hour, we're just sitting there discussing this because his mechanics are fine. It's not his mechanics when he gets in the box.
It's his head.
It's his head.
How big a part is that for successful athletes? And I'm not just talking baseball, softball. I talk a lot about who you are when the lights turn on. Everybody is a home run hitter in the cages. But if you step out on the field and your sphincter looks like this pregame,
it's gonna be a
rough day. I can't use you. It's gonna be a tough day.
Yep.
What do you feel the separator is for the good ball players, good swimmers, good tennis players, and the great ones?
Dealing with adversity, being able to deal with adversity, because I don't care who you are, it's coming. It's coming like a freight train. The guys that can deal with that and can kind of move themselves along are the best. I see it in hitting. I see it in any sport. The person that can deal with the failure, because it's going to happen, the person that can say, I'm going to get right back on the horse here, which, by the way, is not easy, as we both know, but it's over with. So the more we dwell on something that we can't do anything about, it's going to be a really, really hard day. And I feel like with all the better guys that I have, strike one, okay. Strike two, strike three, that's okay, because next at bat, this guy's not going to beat me. And the mindset is everything. I tell this to people all the time. I would say probably 65 to 70% of my athletes see a mental performance coach. This is part of the game now. When I played, no such thing. When you played, I'm assuming, no such thing, right? So we're in a different world right now, but it makes all the difference.
It may, for me, it's interesting to hear you talk about. For me, it's the guys that are able to let it go. Controlling the controllables. So yeah, you know what? I struck out. It's not so what, like, I don't care. It's so what, I have another at bat. And if it's my last at bat, I have another one tomorrow, or I have another one Saturday. Instead of now I struck out and I'm taking that onto the field and now I'm still tight, I'm still tense, and I'm still angry, and the first ball hit to me is gonna be an error.
Yep.
For me, that's the just an incredible separator. One of the best guys I coach, it's really interesting, Matt, Danny Valencia, who's going to be joining us in the next couple weeks, 10-year big leaguer. I asked Danny one time when we were going through the qualifiers in Germany, I said, Danny, you're walking from the dugout or the on-deck circle to the home plate. What's going through your mind? What are you thinking about? And he said, nothing for me to think about. I am the best baseball player on the planet. Now, whether he means that or not, I'm going to get into that with Danny in a couple weeks. When the lights turned on, 10 out of 10 times, Danny Valencia was who I wanted in the batter's box.
Yep.
Does he deal? Yeah, he deals with some of his own anxieties and stuff like that. But this kid performed. For me, that is just the incredible separator of, I'm not going to let this get to me. I'm not going to let this ruin my day. The umpire blew it. My mother didn't bring me an orange Gatorade. I only have red. Dude, so what? For me, what I've taught for so many years is my favorite four-letter word in the entire dictionary. It's not what you think. It's next. I got to be able to move on. I've got to be able to move on to the next play after I made an error, the next at bat if I struck out, the next pitch if the umpire blew one. And so many kids have a tough time. I think that's what they struggle with the most. And for me, as a coach, I've always kind of prided myself. I think in the 25 years I've been coaching, I've yelled on a field three times. Sometimes kids just need an arm around them. And need to be talked to and say, hey, you know, that didn't work. What could we do different next time? And I see you doing that with these kids. I see you asking them what they felt in that position, in that pitch. Do your guys send you game video, live at bats, and ask you to break that stuff down for them? How much of that do you do?
All the time. All the time. I think that's probably the most important video we're going to watch. As you know, in a cage, the setting's a little bit different. Not a lot of people around, kind of getting those, you know, feel goods coming at you. And in a box, that pitcher's trying to beat you every step of the way. That's why we try to make the situations in here as hard as we possibly could. That video that they send me preseason is the most important video. And to be honest, 9.5 times out of 10, it's always about their timing. I'm not really concerned about their mechanics once we get into the season. Of course, there's always an outlier, something's looking a little weird, but for the most part, I'm looking for guys that are on time, that are hungry, looking like, if I'm in as a pitcher, I'm scared of that guy. Mm-hmm. That guy's gonna swing at every pitch and shut it down. That guy's not gonna be watching pitches go by, kind of being a little bit timid. that's what I'm looking for when I get a game video or a live at bat or anything like that.
So hitting is simple.
It's just not that easy.
It's just not that easy, right?
Yep.
Shout out to Kevin Wilson.
K-Dubs.
I've got to have my mechanics right.
Yep.
I've got to control my emotion.
Yep.
And I've got to look for something good to hit.
Yep.
And then I'll be successful doing what I'm doing.
Yep.
MP Baseball is doing really well right now, and I couldn't be happier for you. What's next for Matt Perper?
I don't know. I enjoy what I'm doing. I'm never going to take coaching out forever because I still miss it. I miss putting the uniform on. I miss, aspects of being in a game-like situation. But right now, this works. I got two young kids at home that I love to death. I'm really enjoying the time I'm getting with them because I don't think I would get that same time if I was, you know, on a field or coaching at a school. So I think right now, I think we're going to stay, you know, here, but there's no end game right now. I think just helping guys is what I enjoy.
So, you know, he's talking about a great family. He's got a beautiful wife and two amazing children. Really an incredible family. Any possibility of growing MP Base and taking on guys that you can train to be and teach and learn as you do?
It's been a thought of mine for sure. Have definitely crossed paths with a lot of people that I've discussed that with. And I think it's always an opportunity to grow, because if I can help more people, obviously I'm only one person, so I can only be in one spot, but if I can help more people along this journey and kind of let them see where we're at in this whole thing, would be awesome, honestly. Always open to that.
You know, I will tell you, I know your dad is incredibly proud of you. You lost your mom some years back, and I know wherever she is, she's looking down and she's incredibly proud. I'm proud. You know, I've always looked at you as one of my own. And it's just crazy to me that it is 18 years now that we've known each other. I'm not going to get into it here, but instead of you playing for me, I actually played for you.
You did.
At Fordham University, probably about 15 years ago.
Needed an arm, man.
I needed an arm. and old Eric Holtz came in to throw relief for Coach Perper.
And shut it down for everybody that's listening.
Yeah, I did okay. Whatever you do in the future, I know you're going to be incredibly successful with. I wish you nothing but success in continuing to do what you do and helping athletes overcome the day-to-day and the adversity and stuff like that. So thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thanks for having me, man. This was awesome.
Of course.
This was awesome.
And thank you for joining us once again. Obviously, you know, my journey is just one that there are no words to describe. I get to hang out with human beings like this and like Danny Wierchanski and so many other people that you're going to get to meet throughout this journey. Matt Perper helps kids on a daily basis. And for me, that's what this is about. It's helping the next generation set and achieve realistic goals. And it's not just about being in the cage and helping them, you know, hit a fastball or a curveball. It's helping them through their entire journey and becoming mentors to them and helping them grow as human beings. Thanks for joining us today. Go out, subscribe, send this to your friends, let them know about this. And we look forward to seeing you again on 90 Feet Away. Thank you so very much.